You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast for writers and curious readers about the world of books. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Abby Frucht, co-author of A Well-Made Bed, published by Red Hen Press. Abby was one of my advisors at the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Writing program. She was one of my favorite teachers. Her work is always interesting, and I was really excited to talk to her this week about her new novel, A Well-Made Bed, published by Red Hen Press, and co-authored by Vermont author Lori Alberts. It's an interesting book, and it was so much fun to talk to Abby about what it's like to collaborate with someone on a project as large as a novel. Abby Frucht has received two National Endowment for the Arts fellowships. She has published 5 novels, 2 collections of stories. She's been awarded a Quality Paperback Book Club Prize, the Iowa Short Fiction Prize, and a Best of the Web citation. She teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts and was one of the judges this year for the Penn Faulkner Award. Abby's friend and co-author, Vermont writer Lori Alberts, was unable to join us for this conversation, but I hope to catch her soon as well. Here's a little information about A Well-Made Bed. Nearly 15 years after the death of her childhood friend in a violent hit-and-run accident, Noor Khan is still in the midst of a struggle. With a failing equestrian business and suspicions of an unfaithful husband, her years of physical and psychological therapies have driven her to cross a line that blurs what is law and what is right. When Noor's homesteading neighbor, J.C., gives her the chance to save her business and her marriage through the underground cocaine market, the two fall into a world of murder, copyright infringement, dementia, and one large Peruvian cheese wheel that has them trapped in the morally ambiguous lifestyle they may have desired all along. When I spoke with Abby Frucht, I began by asking her how this collaboration with Lori Alberts began.
Really, it really just sort of happened by virtue of Lori and I knowing each other for quite a long time. Both of us had finished big writing projects. This was back in 2010, mm-hmm. May 2010. And by then we had just finished and published, you know, things that were important to us. And neither of us had ever collaborated on anything before. And we hadn't even spoken at all about it in advance of this event, which was I got up in the morning and I read the newspaper and I read an article about Alzheimer's patients or elderly dementia patients who wander, and the detective whose role it is to track down such patients was being interviewed and made the point that people who are wandering when they have dementia tend to go toward water, either because their body knows they will eventually need water, mm-hmm. or because water, in terms of geographically, is a way out of the spot you're in, or marks a way out of the place you might feel trapped in. But they also tend to return to places that were important to them, or at least walk in the direction that they think will lead to a place that was important to them. So it just dawned on me that it would make an interesting idea, a fun idea for a novel about an elderly dementia patient who was wandering toward the scenes of his crimes, and in my mind he was a serial killer, and he had a daughter, an adult daughter, who was following him and therefore learned about the scenes of all his crimes and was then clued in gradually to this terrible past that he had. But I also knew that I wouldn't even attempt to write such a novel myself because I'm not a plot-oriented writer and I'm not very skilled historically at creating cause and effect and that kind of thing. And I'm also not a very grounded writer. My characters tend to be kind of loopy and obsessive and notably off-kilter, especially lately. So I called Lori because I admire her work for its groundedness, for her characters' surety about who they are and their relationship to the world, for her own empirical grasp of the world of her stories and mm-hmm. her novels, and the way she imparts that to and through her characters. And also because she is a storyteller in a way that I'm not. She's just more sane in that way than I am. So I said, do you want to write this novel about this elderly dementia patient who turns out to be a serial killer and leads his daughter around and shows her all the places that he committed his crimes? She said, no, that sounds ridiculous. That sounds stupid. And it turned out that that was basically Lori's response to almost all questions, but at the time, that's her initial response. It's like a wall she puts up, you know, before she begins to consider things. But anyway, at the time I didn't know this, and we just started chatting because we were friends, and eventually, in that very conversation, we thought, well, we could start writing a novel together, because neither of us had any inclination to write anything at all on our own at that point.
Yeah.
So we did.
Did you do any sort of dry run, like, let's collaborate on a story or something first, or did you just decide
to leap right into it?
Wow.
No. I mean, I know I'm not the kind of writer anyway who has any advance notice in my own mind about what I'm trying to write.
Okay.
Generally. And I guess Lori is much more that way than I am, but we did not experiment. I guess we sort of both realized that if it didn't work out, we didn't have to continue.
Right.
You know.
Now, and you're friends for a long, long time.
We're friends for about, I don't know when she first showed up here, but I think it was something like 96,
okay.
97. I have a bad sense of time, too.
How long have you been here?
94.
Okay.
So Lori probably didn't come here till 98 or 99. But
okay. No, so what I was going to ask is, as friends, you probably had to set some guidelines to make sure that your friendship was not in jeopardy if there were disagreements.
We had very few guidelines, and our friendship was always in jeopardy. And I don't remember, to tell you the truth, how much our friendship was always in jeopardy before we started writing a novel together. But our only real guideline was that over the course of ample discussion, ample revision, ample creation, ample touching up of things, sharing of manuscripts, etc., if we could not reach an agreement on a detail or on a line of prose or something like that, because we really were working together on a line-by-line basis when it came down to that.
Yeah.
If we couldn't agree, then the person who had initiated that chapter or that character had the final say.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. So we didn't even have to fall back on that very many times.
All right, so I was wondering what your shared process was like. Did you organize, did you have an organizing principle? Did you take turns on chapters or scenes or characters, or how did that work?
We didn't really take turns because we were writing at the same time as each other.
Okay.
You know, so it's not as if I waited around while Lori was writing her chapters and she waited around while I was writing mine. Although there were lots of things going on in our lives that interfered with one or another of our ability to write at any given time. So there were moments, of course, when one of us was writing and the other one wasn't. But generally, I think it fell to me to sort of write that what is now the prologue at the very beginning. And so at that point, I was the only one who was writing. We didn't know it was going to be the prologue.
So you wrote the beginning?
I did.
With Pauline?
Yes.
Interesting.
And then, of course, well, I wrote the beginning and in a way sort of imagined the existence of that particular array of characters. Mm-hmm. Not all of the characters that ended up being in the book, but the principal ones that we started out knowing were there came from pretty much from that prologue.
Yeah.
Although I didn't flesh any of those characters out in my mind at the time, nor did I know that the book would necessarily jump out of their childhood toward their adulthood.
Okay.
You know, that wasn't something I established. All of our chapters, including this, which is now the prologue, went through ample revision and back and forth observation by both of us, such that at the end we don't really know who wrote what line.
Okay.
In almost any line of prose has modifications that were made by one or the other of us, so it's almost impossible for even us to say, even whole chapters, because later there were chapters that we shared and sort of you know, had free rein with in a way that we didn't with JC, and nor JC was my chapter character, nor was Lori's.
That I did think that, but mm-hmm. I think that was sort of obvious to me because I know Lori has horses.
Right.
But anyway, yeah. Yeah,
and I'm crazy.
No. Well, like the boiled cookies. I'm like, that's mm-hmm. Abby.
Yeah. So anyway, so we had that sort of organizing principle that I was doing JC and Lori was being Nor. But on the other hand, there were events and characters that were, you know, more free-floating and that we did sometimes just sit down together and brainstorm about and did a lot more rearranging and reconception of those characters together than apart. Mm-hmm. Hill would be one of those.
Hill, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Hillary Emery, mm-hmm. who's JC's father.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that was a great character. Interesting character. So I found it interesting that the narration begins with Pauline, who is not actually long for this fictive world. Mm-hmm. I feel like I can say that because it's on the cover of the mm-hmm. book. Mm-hmm. But when you wrote that, you knew that.
No.
No. Well, by the end of writing it, you knew that.
The chapter?
Yeah.
I guess I sort of did. I mean, it doesn't explicitly say
what happens to
what
any
happens
of them. That's
at
true.
The end to it, at all.
That's true.
And
right,
or
yeah.
to any one of them. And frankly, I don't honestly remember if I knew, if I even bothered to know. Because sometimes what's the difference whether I knew or not? You
right.
know, if Lori and I are going to embark on this book together and anything you write is subject to change, what good does it do to think you know
where it goes,
where a chapter even ended when it ends on a note of uncertainty? That uncertainty is sort of more important to me than that knowledge. And I know a lot of writers, not all writers operate that way.
Yeah.
A lot of writers would feel very uncomfortable with that. And it might help me someday to know more than I do about my characters. But this wasn't one of those times.
I may have asked you this in previous interviews, but I know that you don't tend to spend a lot of time with plot before you're writing, like you mm-hmm. have said. And I was curious if it takes you longer to write because of that. Do you tend to find yourself going off down a path that you then kind of have to back up and think, no, this isn't working?
Well, in my essays that I'm working on now, the backing up ends up being part of the essay.
Mm.
You know, so there's a lot of spiraling around among theoretical positions, you know, with
and
regard
the reader
to the
stays
material.
In the spirals with you.
Yes,
okay.
I mean, and that seems to be a lot of the driving purpose behind the writing of the essay. The problem there is that sometimes I really don't know. At some point, I have to decide what I'm writing about.
Right.
You know, with this novel, that was another reason that I wanted so much to collaborate with Lori, is that you're really saved from that responsibility. Because, for instance, back to the last question,
yeah.
when I end on an unresolved note with that prologue, it's an invitation to Lori to pick it up from there and provide the answer to that particular event, right? And then when she ends her chapter, it provides me a jumping off point for the next chapter.
And yet you were working simultaneously, so...
Yes, but only at one point or another. Then everything in this book was revised by one and or both of us probably at least 10 times.
Okay.
So while I might have started writing my following chapter without knowing what Lori was going to provide for the interim, I had ample time to sort of reimagine it, plus we ended up moving chapters around. You know, there were times when I just, and Lori just, created a moment in the book without knowing where it would go.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, Hill has several sections in the book. He's the demented character, and he's JC's father, writer of children's books, but there are moments when his dementia is paramount, and... initially, that was one long chapter, and I don't quite remember how we decided to chop that chapter into pieces and spread them out over the novel, but they weren't like that initially. And there were other moments in the book, too, that we rearranged in accordance with what had ended up coming to light.
Okay.
And that's, you know, it's really not that different in with regard to that kind of answer. It's not that different from writing a book by yourself. You can always rearrange.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was just that this sort of took a lot of the edge off needing to know what was going to happen next. You didn't need to know what was going to happen next because the other person knew it.
Was this kind of like having a built-in... I mean, it's interesting. I think a lot of people will join a writing group because they would like some sort of, not collaboration, but encouragement and support as they go. It sort of works that way, I would think, for both of you as you're working.
It made for a really lovely experience to know that whatever I was writing was going to be read by someone who trusted me as a writer, uh-huh. who would have something very honest and constructive to offer about it, whose own work at that moment, because she was writing the same book, depended on it. And therefore, we were both free to offer whatever degree of criticism, if you like that term, or revision, modification, reimagine things. You know, there were no holds barred in our conversation with each other when it came to examining every line of this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun. And, you know, I am not the kind of person, I've never been a member of a writing group.
Mm-hmm.
I never even went to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a reader of my work in progress anymore. And this was an automatic reader,
yeah.
and not just an objective reader, a subjective reader.
This is kind of a trivial question, but I am curious. Did you just talk on the phone all the time? Did you Skype with each other so you could see each other? How did
we,
you do that?
We wrote a lot back and forth on the manuscripts. So we would send each other manuscripts. That was a lot of our fighting had to do with that because I was using track changes and Lori couldn't stand them. And so we fought about that for a while. Yes, and then we had a phone call at least once a week, and we Skyped with each other frequently. I don't remember how much, but a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it just became a regular part of our correspondence. And there were things we really wanted to, when we wanted to talk through the larger issues and do a little bit of assessment of what had happened, you know, in a sort of holistic scale, that was a better time to Skype.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other times when we were in some disarray about how to come to an agreement about smaller changes we were making on the manuscripts. And at that point, we Skyped, too.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the book itself. One thing that I love is that this book involves people's secrets, and there are a lot of secrets that get exposed through the course of reading the narrative. And I just wondered if we could talk a little bit about why people love reading secrets. Why is that something that's so appealing to a reader?
You know what's really funny is I don't like reading about secrets.
Oh, you don't?
And when I come to a book on the library shelf and it says, oh, all these family secrets are revealed, I automatically turn away from such a book. So it's not a topic that appeals to me.
Okay.
And I didn't even realize that, until the book was underway, that, yeah, this book was going to have secrets.
And maybe it's not how you would have marketed it.
No, it probably isn't. But I think that the reason it appeals to people is that everybody does have, to some degree, parts of themselves that they don't show.
Mm-hmm.
In public, or just don't show in the world, and also everybody has parts of themselves that are, in some way, kept hidden even from themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, also secrets are a convenient way to create conflict and misunderstanding in a piece of fiction.
Oh, right, sure, mm-hmm. That makes sense.
You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast about writing. Today, my guest is Abby Frucht, co-author with Vermont writer Lori Alberts of the novel A Well-Made Bed, published by Red Hen Press.
The book has to do with drugs and drug trafficking, among many other things. So the characters have ethical concerns about what they're thinking of doing, which is selling drugs to earn some money. And I wondered, as writers, did you have ethical concerns? Like, did it concern you about how this would turn out for your characters because you wanted them to be a certain kind of person or not a certain kind of person?
No, it did not concern me, except we did have a debate about Jerry.
Okay.
Jerry is, you know who Jerry is.
Yes.
He's the point man. He's the man who they bring the drugs to, who's a connection between the two women and the big dealer
right.
in Burlington, okay?
Right. He was a classmate of Noor's
yes.
many years ago.
Lori created Jerry. I love Jerry. He's my favorite character in the book.
I like
He's
him.
Probably everyone's favorite character in the book. And initially, it was revealed in one of Lori's lines that not only was Jerry serving as go-between between Noor and JC and this dealer in Burlington, but he was also sort of a petty drug dealer himself. And I said to Lori, no, not Jerry. He has that plow and, you know, he does landscaping and he can't be a drug dealer.
He's a good guy.
And Lori said, what are you talking about? Noor and JC are drug dealers. I said, I know, but I don't want Jerry to be a drug dealer. And of course, the way I told you before, the formula was if we had a disagreement, it went to the person who created that moment in the book or that chapter. And so Lori went out there. And then later on, I still even pressed for Jerry to become a nurse or to want to become a nurse, to apply to nursing school, because I really like him and I want him to make good decisions and make himself happy and serve his true purpose in life, which in my mind is to be a nurse, because I think he's a really comforting person to be around. That didn't go either, of course.
She rejected.
But that was the only time when I had any misgiving at all about allowing one or another character to harm themselves or even another person. There's no violence yes, there is some violence in the book, but not on the part of Noor and JC.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of us would have quailed at that possibility. But in terms of JC turning out to have it in her to betray people, that's part of who she is because she needs to move out of where she is in life. Her own needs take precedence over those even of the people she wishes so much to be friendly with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just part of who she is. So no, there was never any point except with Jerry where I felt
mm-hmm.
I felt guilty or bad. I did meet with a book group recently, and somebody made the comment that they felt guilty reading the book.
They felt guilty?
They felt guilty.
Because they were rooting for these women?
I guess so.
That's
interesting. I didn't quite understand the comment, but it interested me.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that's a compliment to the work, because you've done a good job of presenting these characters that we care about, even though they're making choices that we have to kind of wonder about.
You want people to see themselves in the characters and
yeah.
also examine themselves in a way that they might not have done before.
Right.
Yeah.
The book is set in Montpelier,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that was interesting. It's a place that you and Lori share as
right.
a place that you are both really familiar with. But outside of that, when you're working, do you have any thoughts about choosing a real place versus an invented place?
Me in my own work?
Yeah.
I think almost everything I've ever written has been in an identifiable place.
It has.
And that I have felt a certain degree of familiarity. I don't think I've ever invented a place. I've invented qualities of place, like the museum fire in my novel, can't even remember the name, Life Before Death. you know, it burns down and then the remaining artifacts in the museum have the ability to show people what their futures are. So that's obviously not a real thing about that place, but the place in that book is Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where I live, and that museum is the Oshkosh Public Museum, which did burn down. So even then, when I bring a degree of inventiveness or surreality to the events of the book, the place is, yeah, in my mind, pretty secure.
Okay.
And Lori and I did do a lot of driving around when we were up here together, scouting out locations,
walking around
campus.
It's very identifiable. It's very accurate. I kept coming across things that I know because I spend a lot of time in Montpelier, so it was
mm-hmm.
fun. I think people find that fun.
It was fun for us too.
What about the setting? Another setting was Peru, where J.C.
Oh wait! I have to interrupt myself.
Yeah.
And you. But Hillwinds doesn't exist.
Oh right.
That whole phenomenon where J.C. is raised.
Right.
I mean, it's here in Montpelier in the book, but it's totally not a real place.
Right. Which is like it's supposed to be sort of like a historic village and theme park, and there's all kinds of aspects to
it. Right.
Yeah.
And that's not real.
Right. Peru. Has either of you been to Peru, or did you write from a distance?
I traveled quite a bit there because my son lived there for 3 years.
Oh, okay.
So I visited him 3 times, and we had great trips together, and every detail about Peru, almost every detail about Peru, came directly from those travels.
And were you working on this while you were traveling there?
You
just took lots of notes.
Mm-hmm.
And
in my mind, I took notes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you, and I know Lori has lectured about this, spoken about this, and that is language, foreign language in fiction, and presenting foreign language in fiction. Mm-hmm. And you have Spanish in here, and then there's a section where there's a character named Carlos who's Italian, I think.
No, he's Peruvian.
He's Peruvian. Why do I have Italian?
The only people who were Spanish speakers, who were speaking English in the book, because they speak English too, were Frida and Carlos, I think, and maybe some members of Frida's family.
So I just find this really interesting, partly because I'm trying to work on something like this now, and the extent to which you balance a foreign element and then translate it or just leave it unexplained, that sort of thing.
I don't think we had many words that we left unexplained.
Yeah.
I mean, we really, I think, opted for, eventually, and over the course of revision, opted for allowing their words to appear in English, knowing that there may be an accent involved that we weren't going to try to duplicate on the page. Every so often we might, make a slight dramatical shift just to remind the reader that this was someone who was speaking English as a second language.
Right. I think it's actually J.C., and she's inventing stuff. And that's,
she is, when she's speaking Spanish.
And
she's trying to speak Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she cobbles
it's
words.
It's a aussi. I guess I thought it was Italian because it wasn't Spanish.
No, that's J.C. fumbling her foreign language speaking.
That's what it is. I desire a wet egg, she might be saying.
Yes, exactly.
That was awesome.
One thing we didn't want to do, and we actually took pains not to do this, was to be amused by other people's accents, mm-hmm. Or anything like that.
Right.
We didn't want to prioritize the English speakers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. How much of a desire did you have to remain accurate? So with storylines concerning drug trafficking and laws and customs, did you do a lot of research, or did you mainly kind of go by what you intuit or know about those worlds from the news?
Part of the reason we made our characters so ignorant of drugs and drug trafficking is because both of us were so ignorant about drugs and drug trafficking.
Okay.
So we did probably the minimum possible amount of research you could even imagine doing on such a subject. I just read Sam Quinones's book, Dreamland, the look at the opiate industry in the United States. It's a recent National Book Award winner, really great book.
Okay.
Historical sort of overview of heroin and opiate trafficking and addiction in this country. And it would have been a different book had my book with Lori would have been a different book had that book come out before. Had we known that information, it would have been a different book.
Would have been more accurate, or you would have included more detail?
Because there are so many facts in there that really interest me.
Do you feel like that can also be maybe heavy in a fiction? Or
no, I don't think we would have let it get heavy.
Oh, okay.
I think certainly it could have, but I think both of us are skilled enough at avoiding exposition that wouldn't have happened. So it just because we would have known more. There were so many things that we learned over the course of writing this book that had we written the book now, been writing it now instead of then, would have been an element in the book. And that's probably true no matter what book you're ever writing when.
Mm-hmm.
you know, our lives changed over the, it took us 4.5 years to write the book. My parents died, Lori lost a brother, our kids grew up, we both had illnesses and or injuries, you know, the world changed. Mm-hmm. And so just, there's always a sort of decisive moment, a decisive element of every book ever written that is determined solely by sort of historical chance, you know, when do you start putting the pen to the paper,
right?
You know,
and what's affected you that day. Mm-hmm. And how will it affect what you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I would have had one of JC's parents die in the novel had my parents died by the time I wrote this book. Mm-hmm. Because I learned about death. Mm-hmm. And I learned about, you know,
going through that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it wasn't as if I said to myself beforehand, oh, I wish I knew this. It didn't even occur to me. No. As an element, because they were, you know, they were just marching around being themselves.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I don't know if anything in particular comes to mind with this question, but were there any particular pleasant surprises that came from Lori, or that you know came from you to Lori in writing this, where it was like, oh my God, I love this thing you just wrote that I wasn't expecting?
I know Lori felt that way about the drug and the cheese, being inside the cheese. I hadn't told her about it because I didn't know about it until I wrote it that way. So it was a secret from me too, but I'm used to kind of surprising myself when I'm working. The biggest surprises, I think, well, first of all, I really love Jerry.
Yeah,
I knew I would love Lori's characters because of how connected they are to the earth, and because of how self-aware they are. Mm-hmm. And how they articulate that self-awareness. So while there was an element of surprise in the details of her characters, the fact that they were so elegant did not surprise me, because I knew that they would be that way. Mm-hmm. What the biggest surprises came in terms of our approaches to the actual act of writing, to the process. Mm-hmm. That things that we learned from each other by virtue of having to work together and adhere to certain of the other's principles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I liked this, and I wanted to talk about conflict in fiction. Okay, so this is Nora's thinking about whether or not to turn JC in when she's first come to her with this kind of crazy plan to sell these drugs. She could give JC, she's talking about Jerry, she could give JC his name, but she wouldn't. She wasn't going to get involved in JC's illicit activities. No way. This was just a weird story to tell Dan. He'd shake his head and suggest she report it to the cops. She wouldn't do that, though. The senior Emerys were too desperate and JC too pitiful to turn in, which meant, Nora realized, that if JC were a normal person, a person with a life she didn't want to throw away, Nora would turn her in. There was no end to the ways Nora unnerved herself. There was a lot going on there where she's thinking about whether or not she's going to take this action or that action, and her motivations and the complication and conflict seemed really good for fiction. So mm-hmm. I just wondered if we could talk about that a little bit.
About that particular passage?
Or the larger idea also. Mm-hmm. Of just sort of like how complication improves fiction and how complicated feelings improve character.
Mm-hmm.
So
some of that does come from the writer not knowing exactly what's coming next.
Yeah.
I'm reading a book now. I won't name it because I'm not enjoying it, but the reason I'm not enjoying it is a book of short stories. The reason I'm not enjoying it is because I feel that the character knows too much. I mean, the author knows too much, or thinks she understands all there is to know about her, all there is to understand about her characters. Mm. And I feel that her understanding of them amounts not to an agenda necessarily, but it ropes them in. And not that I believe that characters act on their own in fiction, I've never believed that, but her characters feel sort of, I don't know, hobbled and a little bit pre-made.
Yeah.
To me. So what that one of those, you know, definitely when you're working with another person and you don't know what's coming around the corner, you know, what manuscript you're going to see in the mail, a week from then, whatever time you're in, you have that ability to exercise your uncertainty mm-hmm. and to articulate your uncertainty. And I think that translates into the character's ability to sort of vacillate between polarizing ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And that was something that came too when, since Laurie and I were working together on each individual passage and each individual line, it was almost natural for us to forge that kind of self-interrogation,
mm-hmm.
especially on Nora's part, because that was the kind of character she was. JC doesn't do it that much, because she doesn't examine herself to the degree that Nora does.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that's so right also, because she's never had the indulgence of being able to be self-aware in a way, because her every move was dictated by her parents. You know, she's homeschooled, she's mm-hmm. not allowed to do this, she's not allowed to do that. Even at the point where the book opens, she's taking a trip and she has to tell them she's going to Burlington because it's right. the only thing they'll let her do.
Right. No, she doesn't, yeah. and she does not doubt herself.
Yeah.
She doesn't stop herself. She doesn't interrogate herself, nor does. And two, a lot of those moments came from, you know, Laurie feeling very certain about an element of Nora's character. In a way I admire, because like I said, her characters are self-aware and tied to who they know they are on Earth. But my inclination would be to say, but wait a minute, what about the alternative
mm-hmm.
here? You know, so naturally we sort of fell into that with Nora. It was fun.
Now, there's a point in the book where Nora is suspicious that her husband might be having an affair.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, was Laurie, like, did she have, like, a very specific action that Nora should take that you maybe pushed back against? That? Just thinking about the way you've described your different approaches.
I think, if I remember correctly, and from looking at some of the pages that we've saved, you know, to talk about when we're giving lectures mm-hmm. and stuff, I think that we stretched out her realization that Dan was having an affair a little beyond where initially Laurie had imagined it would be stretched out. So mm-hmm. from in other words, the time and the amount of events that transpired between Nora's initial suspicion and Nora's the confirmation,
mm-hmm.
you know, there were storylines that evolved around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
That allowed her to confirm that suspicion.
Yeah.
I don't think all of those storylines were in place when Laurie first realized that
okay.
her husband was having an affair.
Yeah, I'm glad you stretched it out because it gave me as a reader the opportunity to kind of keep wondering, mm-hmm. well, maybe this will happen now, maybe this will happen now, which I think is part of the excitement of figuring out where it's going.
And some of that too comes from the fact that we reorganized parts of the book. So we might have confirmed the affair and then later found ourselves writing other mm-hmm. parts, like for that visit to Mindy's house when they actually visit.
Yeah, that was great.
The house.
That would have been like one of the first things I did.
Yeah, well, that Laurie created that idea, but I think that idea came to her after we had sort of thought we were almost finished with exploring whether or not Dan was having an affair.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Laurie might remember better than I do, but...
Yeah. I wondered what you personally are working on now. What are you writing? You said you're writing essays.
You know, I did just finish judging the Penn Faulkner competition, and we read 500 books,
oh,
me and the two other judges, over a 6-7 month period.
Wow.
And so really right now, I am just trying to get back on my feet as a reader and a writer.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoy doing it. I've been trying to get back into some essays that I had started beforehand. As usually happens when I'm here at Vermont College, I get some new ideas about things I want to experiment with when I get home. So that's a good thing.
And you just mentioned that you were reading a book of short stories that you don't really want to identify the author, but is there anything else that you've read lately that you might recommend?
I've been reading nonfiction since...
Yeah.
First of all, I recommend the winners of the Penn Faulkner competition. I mean, the way we came to them was that, you know, there are three separate judges. We don't know each other. We had not met each other prior to receiving these abundant boxes of books in the mail. But at the end of the 6 months... We were tasked with each creating a short list of 20 books, and there was an overlap of something like 12 books across the board. Not that there were 12 books that showed up on all three of our lists, but from judge to judge, there were at least 12 books that overlapped, something like that. And that was fascinating in and of itself, to think that we would be looking at 500 books. And yes, we were corresponding over the course of reading them together, knowing what caught somebody's eye, what they want to read through to the end of and what they don't want to read through to the end of, that kind of thing. But still, it was surprising how much overlap that was. And at first I believed that had to do with the three judges being somehow sort of magically very fortunately simpatico,
right.
And being in line with each other. But now I really think it has to do with the originality and exuberance of the five novels that we eventually chose.
Yeah.
That they really did rise to the top for their own reasons, and that, and in fact, to corroborate that, a week after we named our four finalists and a winner, one of those finalists won the Pulitzer Award.
Oh, wow.
Now, what that means to me is there was another group of judges reading another group of 500 novels, maybe more, and again, that same book came to the top, and not because those judges were sort of conveniently alike.
Right.
It was because that book was so good.
Yeah.
And so interesting.
Now, do you want to name the books
yeah,
you're talking about?
I'll name all the books. First,
okay.
First of all, our winner of the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction this year was Delicious Foods by James Hanaham. The finalists were Viet Thanh Nguyen, and his book was The Sympathizer, and that's the one that also won the Pulitzer.
Oh, okay.
Elizabeth Talent's book of stories, Mendocino Fires.
Okay.
Julie Iramuana's first novel, Mr. and Mrs. Doctor. That was our only small press book. It was a coffee house press book.
Oh, wow.
Which I'll get back to that in a minute. And finally, Luis Alberto Urrea's book of beautiful short stories, The Water Museum.
Okay. All right.
And the only other thing I wanted to point out, the Julie Iramuana book, Mr. and Mrs. Doctor, was our only small press book, and it was also the only one, unfortunately, which says something about publishing these days, which when I went into bookstores, which I did a lot of because I happened to be traveling, and I said, do you have these books? Can you shelve them all together, all the five finalists? Invariably, if they didn't have one of them and they had the other four, that was the one they didn't have.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that's a good small press. It's a long-standing one. It's not, something that's going to disappear a year from now.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, let's see. I guess my last question is, will you and Lori collaborate again? And can you offer any advice to writers who are considering a collaboration?
I honestly don't know if we'll collaborate again. I mean, it was a lot of work. I can't say it was more work than writing a novel on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But my answer might be very different from Lori's.
Mm-hmm.
Because I enjoyed working with her, and because I enjoyed that give and take, I would say I would welcome the opportunity to work with Lori again, at least experimentally, using a different format than we did before, just to make it different for us.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we talked about this briefly a couple months ago. We talked about possibly, if we were to write another book together, we talked about collaborating on a paragraph by paragraph basis rather than a chapter by chapter basis.
Oh, wow.
Just to get more, even more integrated in our styles and inclinations than we are in this book. So we did talk about, and that's what I would like to do. I think it would be fun. I think it would be an experiment. It would be a puzzle. It would be an exercise that might bear some good fruit. I don't know. But the question of whether we will is totally up in the air.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then advice for people who want to do this?
I think that, when you're collaborating with someone, you have two different sort of opposing sets of obligations. One is to relinquish certain of your stylistic and sort of artistic habits and inclinations, mm-hmm. choices that you would ordinarily make, and the other is to uphold them. You know, so you have to eventually, not necessarily at the very beginning, decide which of your stylistic tics or whatever you want to call them, or pursuits might be a better word, are the ones you want to uphold for this book and which ones you're going to let go of.
And then do you feel like it's important that your collaborator have input into which of your stylistic pursuits?
Yes, necessarily that would be the case.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Lori changed her work habits because of certain of my limitations mm-hmm. when we started out.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really view them as limitations per se. Lori viewed them as limitations, but she, I can tell you exactly what I'm talking about if you'd rather.
Sure.
So I wasn't talking in hypothetical terms,
yeah.
theoretical terms. I like to really examine the work on a molecular basis as I go along from the very beginning. So I'm making the smallest possible choices from the beginning as a way of exploring possibilities in terms of the words, in terms of the punctuation, because that's how I learn what my character is going to do next. For example, when I mentioned earlier that I didn't know that the drugs were going to be in the cheese, right?
Right.
Well, remember the scene when they're in the car and they're going to slice into that
yeah.
cheese and eat some of it.
They're in a parking lot.
Well, the beginning of that is kind of embarrassing to talk about, but you know the term cut the cheese means you're passing gas, right?
Yeah.
So I couldn't just write they cut the cheese because that would just be ridiculous and
right.
an unintended embarrassing moment.
Right.
You know, so I said, well, how else can I put this? So I allowed Noor to sort of press the knife into the crust of the cheese, and then the knife popped through, and then I scrutinized that sentence a little, and I thought, well, if it popped through, what kind of sound is it going to make? And then I scrutinized it a little more and thought, this is an awful lot of knife work on the cheese for it just to be a cheese. You know, surely there's got to be something else going on here. So that's why there's the drug in the cheese.
Which changed everything.
You know, of course, there would have been some other element that, I don't know what the book would have been about if that element hadn't happened. But I came to that because that's the kind of writer I am, who didn't just write, oh, well, just write, they cut the cheese and we'll go back and change that later so it's not so embarrassing.
Right.
Lori likes to, you know, I guess do what you would call get your ideas and get the story on paper, which is probably why she's better at plot than I am, and then do go back later and sort of fix things and play around with them and experiment with them. And I heard another writer talking today about saving the smaller molecular moments for the end when it's time to so-called polish up the
right.
manuscript. That's completely antithetical to the way
to your work.
I work.
Yeah.
So it was Lori who said at the beginning, okay, we will do that scrutiny now. You know, and she told me that it changed her entire way of life, not just in writing.
Hmm.
That instead of getting up in the morning and trying to whip through all the things she knows she has to get done during the day, she'll think about it a little bit and sort of pace herself in a different way than she used to.
So in a way she's maybe a little more meditative
yeah, maybe.
About her mm-hmm. approach to things.
Yep.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Abby Frucht, the book is A Well-Made Bed. It's co-authored by Lori Alberts, who couldn't be here to interview today, but hopefully soon. And the press is Red Hen Press. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Pleasure being here.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Abby Frucht, author of A Well-Made Bed, and her co-author is Lori Alberts. You can learn more about their work through their websites, abbyfrucht.net and lorialberts.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Abby Frucht, who recommends considering an invented collaboration. Write the first page of a story, or the first set of pages of a novel. Choose a favorite author whose work you respect, who you feel you can learn from. Then pretend you've asked that author to write the next page, or equivalent number of pages, of your new project. Write their part, keeping in mind what you admire about their work, and see what results. Abby says that doing this can give you license to choose an author from whom you feel like you can learn something. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. I want to make a couple quick announcements about the show. First, Write the Book is presently just podcasting. You may have noticed this. While we wait for access to the Radiator in the former Burlington College building, we are not able to broadcast in the usual way. So stick with the podcasts. We'll be back on the Burlington airwaves soon. Also, I want to just announce that Gary Miller is taking a break from his role as co-host of Write the Book. He is turning his attention to his own writing and to the very good work that he does with Writers for Recovery, a Vermont program that he helped to found. So we thank Gary for his wonderful interviews, and we wish him well. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont.